Yes, this is the hour. We'll take your phone calls with planetary scientist Daniel Derda. So get ready to make the call on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Dan Derda with us, of course. We'll get to your calls in a second. Dan, this primordial soup that's out there in the universe, I would assume, and we've talked about this before, it's got to be the same everywhere, isn't it? Where is Dan? Oh, we're going to have to call him back.
I hope.
All right, Tommy, you call him back. Let's get him back on, and we will get going here. How quickly they disappear. Brand new studio, so you never know. Well, we're not in it yet. We're in a makeshift studio. We're not in our real one yet, but we will. Anyways, our guest this hour is Daniel Derda. He is the planetary scientist. Daniel, you with us now?
Yes.
Okay, where'd you go?
Oh, I don't know. Something just lost the connection for some reason. Okay. Don't know why. But fortunately, we're back.
You are back. We're going to take calls. But I was asking you about this primordial soup in the universe. It seems to be the same everywhere, isn't it?
Well, I mean, again, as far as we can tell from the one limited example we have here on the Earth, we seem to be, you know, the stuff that makes us seems to be some of this most common stuff that we see out there. You know, carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and, you know, water as a solvent for organic molecules. We see this stuff everywhere. And, we don't know if we're made of that stuff because that's what's most common, easiest thing to be out there, or whether there was still some magic combination, and even with all those common materials, it's going to, you know, life is going to be rare. We just don't know the answer yet, and that's why we have this strong primal fascination with trying to better understand where we fit in that context, and therefore that search for other life forms. That's why that's such an important, deep core question to be asking.
Why is this so-called Goldilocks zone, the zone that we're in, so important?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it's because of the processes by which we know organic life to be, we got to have this sort of a magic range of temperature where water, which is this wonderful, beautiful solvent for organic molecules, remains liquid. You go too close to the sun, planet Mercury is so hot that rocks are baked to a arid nothingness. You go too far out and water is frozen into material stronger than rock. And so literally Goldilocks, not too hot, not too cold, is the magic place to be. The interesting thing, though, is that as we've learned more about the properties and the history of the objects in our own solar system, we've come to realize that our original sort of naive ideas of what that Goldilocks zone would be have been expanded. We never knew to expect that you could find an ocean, a global ocean of liquid water under the ice crust of a moon of Jupiter.
That's right.
Or a rich, thick atmosphere full of organic molecules orbiting Saturn. And so that concept of the Goldilocks zone, I think, needs to kind of, you need to have a little bit of extra imagination with it and allow that it can be larger at any given time, and even through history can change as the sun evolves and as planetary systems evolve.
Silly question, but will water freeze at 32.5 degrees Fahrenheit wherever it might be?
Not a silly question at all, because you can do things to water to make to within some reasonable bounds change its
complexity,
that freezing point. Yeah. Seawater, for instance, doesn't freeze at 32 degrees. It freezes at a little bit colder than that because the action of salt, the saline solution, will keep that water from freezing. Now, it's not a huge difference. You're only dropping into about like 29.5 degrees or something like that. But you could do a little bit. But yeah, the basic laws of physics that govern the way that sort of Mickey Mouse shaped water molecule is attracted to other water molecules and therefore binds into a crystalline structure when the temperature drops low enough, that's pretty much the same universe wide. That's the only way science and the universe make any sense to us, is that the rules are the same, as far as we can tell, at least. The rules seem to be the same everywhere we look, and that's what makes it all. What makes the detective story that is science a process that we can actually wrap our brains around.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Wally is a first-time caller in Sacramento, California. Wally, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. I figured out that I shouldn't try to start calling a half hour ago.
I'm a 30-year retiree from AT&T, did 20 years with Bell Labs on the West Coast.
Okay, great.
But, Dan, you made a comment that we don't watch towards the sun for the big whopper thing that's going to kill us. And I heard the thing that, on the tail end, you made a comment of the idea of having a device out there, a sentinel, looking back. So let's see if we can get to yes on looking at the sun. You don't look at it with an optical device. You look at it with a radar, a high-energy pulsing radar, or a thermal imaging device that is tracking a cold spot coming at us, and that way we get to look at something where we're not able to spot that thing coming in, the thing like what we've been missing.
Yeah, good point, Wally. Thanks. Appreciate the question on that. It's a good one. I think, frankly, it's the idea that the Sentinel spacecraft would be, or some spacecraft like it, would be orbiting in closer to the sun than the Earth is, and looking back out. In a sense, that limitation of looking, when I say looking toward the sun, that's a limitation of ground-based, sort of Earth-centric, Earth-based observatories. Now, of course, that goes away a little bit. I think that's the point you were getting at, that if you get off the surface of the Earth, so you don't have that glowing sky-lit atmosphere around us, even an Earth-orbiting spacecraft can now look a bit closer into the sun, in the direction of the sun, that is, and alleviate this problem a little bit. So you're absolutely correct on that. It doesn't even have to all the way necessarily go to radar or the infrared. Even in the visible, you can still do that. But the problem just still gets a lot easier if you move the entire observing platform to an orbit much closer to the, or at least closer to the sun than the Earth is, because now basically all of those potential objects, you don't have to go, when I say the object is coming in from the direction of the sun, you don't go very close to the sun as an Earth-approaching asteroid. Many of these things dip only just slightly in closer to the sun than the Earth orbits. So by going toward the orbit of Venus and looking out, you're really covering, 99.9%, if you will, of that parameter space of objects that can potentially whack us from an incoming orbit coming in from a little bit closer. So infrared is the way to go, because these objects are a bit brighter in the infrared than they are in the visible. But by going in there, that really does solve that problem.
What is it that fascinates you about space, Dan? What's your passion there?
We've been talking about it a little bit. I grew up in this field, being interested in this subject, in this topic, with Carl Sagan's Cosmos, and I really caught that bug that Carl had for asking that big question: are we alone in the universe? And so, even though that's actually not the focus of my day-to-day research, obviously I'm an asteroid guy that we've been talking about. What my passion and my artwork that I do, for instance, all still revolves around this idea of life in the universe, planets around other stars, that grand stage for the play of life. To me, that's the ultimate big question, and that's where, for me, the romance and the beauty of spaces is imagining all of these other worlds and the potential for those other life forms that may be out there. I just hope sometime in my lifetime I can be witness to that discovery, definitive discovery that we're not alone.
Let's go to Jeff in Birmingham, Alabama, now east of the Rockies. Jeff, you're up with us.
Hey, now, just a couple of suggestions and a question, if I may.
Sure.
You said that the you didn't think it was bright to bring an asteroid close to the gravity well. I think that actually might be a good thing to do if you do it correctly. I do seem to remember hearing that an asteroid, if it was or rich, about the size of a football stadium, could pay off the national debt. And I was thinking if you could, the asteroid miners could use our Roach limit. And if you bag an asteroid and the thing starts breaking up and you inflate it with air, remember, when you're trying to recover an astronaut in a space capsule, you have to slow it down a lot. But if you inflate something with a good amount of ore in it, then you just have to slow it down enough to a controlled crash, or you can just roll up to a crater that's not completely vaporized and get a front-end loader and scoop it out, and you don't have to put a bunch of refinery up there. But one of the things I was thinking about using a more solid asteroid for, if you could have it, because you hear a lot about space elevators, and I think a space elevator is a little too long, but if you had an asteroid doing a backspin and trailing a tether, you could use a skyhook and yank a very heavy payload off the Earth's surface, slowing the asteroid down and lifting something heavier than any rocket could put up there. And lastly, you were talking about the B612, and I really have to question that gravity tractor approach, because you're going to have to fly this looping Rosetta-style matching trajectory before you can start your mission pulling away. That's going to take a long time. I wondered if using a nuke, I know there are a lot of anti-nuke activists out there, but a nuke could get on a deep impact style, simpler, faster flyby trajectory, which means the spacecraft's not going to get as rad or as cold soaked. So I just wondered what you thought of that.
All right, a lot of questions here for you, Daniel.
Oh, and many great points. I mean, I really have a hard time picking at anything you just said. I mean, there were a lot of really good suggestions in there that I really don't have any strong disagreements with, quite frankly. I mean, it's all in context and the nuances of the situation. On this very last point about the idea of nuking an asteroid, there really is nothing physically against the idea of blasting one of these objects to oblivion, other than the size, say. In fact, that nuclear option is considered one of our last resort options because it probably would actually work. The thing is, you just don't want to do that literally at the last minute, because you don't want that cloud of debris still interacting with the Earth and passing through the Earth's atmosphere. And I'm not talking just from the radioactivity point of view from the nuclear device. I'm talking about just having the asteroidal material itself vaporizing in the Earth's atmosphere, because the chlorine and the bromine in a typical rocky asteroidal mix, there's enough chlorine and bromine there to do some significant damage to the ozone layer. If it's a large enough asteroid, even something maybe half a mile across is enough to completely destroy the atmosphere from that perspective. So. It would work. I mean, it's just a matter of, do you want to take the risk that you can control the outcome as carefully as you could with some other means, like, for instance, a kinetic kill or the gravity tractor or some other technology like that.
How difficult would it be to slow down an asteroid?
Well, it all depends on the size of the asteroid. Obviously, the smaller the object, the less momentum, the less inertia it has. And so within the technologies we have available to us, we'd much prefer to deal with a small one than a large one. A lot of it also will depend on the actual shape of the orbit itself. If it's in a relatively Earth-like orbit, the crossing speed as the object encounters the Earth is relatively lower. And since the energy that you have to deal with goes like the mass of the object, so the bigger the object, the harder it is to move and to deal with, but it goes as the square of the speed of the object relative to us. And so it's the relative crossing speed that's more important in determining the amount of energy that you have to use to alter or play with the object as it goes by. And if it's a very inclined orbit or a very eccentric orbit, that crossing speed is going to be much higher, and instead of crossing a relative speed with the Earth of, 2 or 3 or 4 kilometers a second, it's going to be more like, 10 or 12 or 15, in which case there's not a whole lot you can do in that situation.
We now go west. Russ is in Portland, Oregon. Hello, Russ. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi. Good evening, George.
Hi.
And Dan. Hey, let me tell you, 30 years ago, I was standing on my back deck, and I was looking at the sky. It was just after sunset, and I saw a meteor go through the upper atmosphere, about 50, 60 miles high, and it was about a mile and a half. I say that's an estimation of the smallest, and I could see the surface of the thing, and then right behind it was another one. Now, I believe now we can maybe see these things coming, but we got to be able to find a way to deflect them. We need the rocket hardware ready to go.
Oh, you bet. Absolutely. I mean, finding them is only the first step, right? Being aware of the situation, being aware of the population is only the first step. It doesn't do you any good to know that there's an object coming to hit you if there's nothing you can do about it. And this is the statement I said earlier about, the dinosaurs went extinct because they didn't have a space program. Well within our technological capability to deflect one of these objects, especially these smaller ones that we're actually discovering these days. It's a matter now of moving beyond the sort of PowerPoint presentation level of concept to actual, experimenting, testing, developing, and doing something about it. It's just like it doesn't do any good to see them coming and not have something to do, it doesn't do any good to have an idea in mind and not actually execute it and be ready to take action when the time comes. And so I'm all in favor of beginning to poke and prod and play with these objects before we find a threatening one. Go out there, find a small asteroid that we know is in an orbit that not only is not dangerous to us now, but couldn't be dangerous to us no matter what we did to it. And go out there and play with this object. Poke on it, press on it, push on it, throw something into it and see how it reacts. It's the only way to test the technologies and the techniques. Find out what works and what doesn't. Break the technology and learn from that. And then when the time comes, when it actually counts, then you're ready to do something that will actually work.
Let's take one more call before the break, Dan, then we'll come back with some final calls for you. Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Bill.
Yes, hi, Dr. Durder. Let me get to my question real quick. You well know better than me, over the next year to a year and a half, we're going to learn, hopefully, if all three missions are successful, a hell of a lot of knowledge about the planet, about our solar system, especially small bodies. I'm thinking of three particular missions. One, the European Space Agency's Rosetta mission that's going to orbit that comet next month and hopefully land on it in November. And then the two NASA missions, Dawn, that will orbit, hopefully, the asteroid Ceres, the largest asteroid in the asteroid belt. And then the third thing is Dr. Alan Stern's New Horizons mission that will hopefully fly by successfully the planet Pluto and its moons next July or August next year. So over the next year, year and a half, we should learn a lot of those three missions. And when after New Horizons flies by Pluto, it'll hopefully fly by a Kuiper belt object.
Oh, you bet. You nailed it exactly. We've got some really exciting times coming. There are some wonderful NASA missions that are provide those great results. It's really kind of a golden age of planetary exploration, and we're seeing the fruits of the labor of these last several years of really hard work by these really dedicated teams. You've got people literally giving up their vacation times, working day and night making these missions happen. It's hard work by a lot of very dedicated people. And it's going to pay off in the beautiful pictures, the inspiration, the knowledge that we've completed this preliminary reconnaissance of the major bodies in our solar system, the biggest asteroids, the smallest planet. If you want to get into that part of the controversy, if you will, We're really rounding out that sort of preliminary reconnaissance. It's a really magic time, and I can't wait to see these new worlds come to life and really get to see them the way they are.
All right, Dan, hang with us. We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM, and we'll take some final phone calls with you. Dan's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And as for us, make sure that you still continue to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and you can do all that by getting to our website as well, coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to our final segment with planetary scientist Daniel Durda as we talk about space and asteroids and all those great things. I still love science, Dan. It's in my blood. I'll probably never get rid of it. How about you?
No. Yeah, I agree 100%. It's why I'm in the field. That's why I love it. And it's clear that's why all our callers love it, too. We've had some really great questions coming in tonight.
If I wasn't 108, I'd go up with you in space.
Well, that's the beauty of the of these new commercial vehicles and the commercial enterprise of putting people in space is that the health constraints are not quite as stringent as the NASA test flights.
No, that's true.
Literally, Grandma next door can go fly to space.
That is absolutely true. So, when do you find out for sure that you're going? You're going.
I know for sure I'm going. It's just I know for sure. We Southwest Research Institute. We have a program of suborbital research to be conducted on these vehicles. We have purchased flight contracts for 9 separate suborbital flights, 6 with X-Corps Aerospace, and 3 with Virgin Galactic. I will be flying, Alan Stern will be flying, and Kathy Olkin. We are the 3 payload specialists from Southwest Research Institute. We'll be flying, conducting some microgravity experiments, an imaging experiment, some biomedical stuff, and basically helping to show that this new generation of vehicles is ready to go fly and ready for scientists, everyday scientists like myself, to go and do our work in the field the same way that, you know, say oceanographers have gone down to the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah.
It's a difficult environment, a dangerous environment, but people have been going there for years, decades, to do their research, and it's time for us space scientists to get the same opportunities.
Where do you launch from? Canaveral or Mojave? Whereabouts?
A little bit of both, actually. When we fly with X-Corps Aerospace, we'll be flying pretty early in their program with them, and so we'll be flying when they're still operating out of Mojave, California. When we fly with Virgin Galactic, we'll be flying deep into their commercial operations when they're already operating out of Spaceport America down near White Sands, New Mexico.
All right, let's go back to the calls. Let's go to Jeff in La Quinta, California on the wildcard line. Jeffrey, you're up.
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I'm glad to see there's so much private money, you know, going in here. I saw, I think it was Shepard on the news today, the second man to walk on the moon. And he says that NASA spends their budget's 0.5%.
Second man on the moon was Buzz Aldrin.
Buzz Aldrin. That's who was on the show then.
Okay.
Today. And, you know, I got to tell you, I've lost a lot of faith in NASA. I want you to ask me see if I got a couple things correct. Right now, the globe is actually in like magnetic flux. I know the pilots have to adjust their stuff every so often, right? Because the magnetic is turning, correct?
The magnetic pole is in a state where it really is starting to show signs about every, you know, several tens of thousands of years. There's evidence geologically that the Earth's magnetic field will go through a period where it will flip polarity. And we've never seen that happen before, but we can imagine that when you get near a period of time when that flip is getting ready to occur, for, you know, several hundred or a couple thousand years around that time, you might notice that the magnetic poles are wandering around and moving and changing strength a bit.
Well, they're doing that now.
We certainly do see that. Yeah, we certainly do.
The commercial pilots have to set their, I saw this on Discovery, they have to set their, you know, their equipment like every 2 or 3 weeks because it moves that much. Maybe it's just a percent or two. But, in any case, you know, with the Earth moving, which means maybe the South Pole gets more snow and the North Pole gets less snow as this takes place, and America's spending our kids' future on global warming, you know, I'm all for keeping everything healthy. But if this administration would have spent 1/10 of what it spent on green energy to put into the space. And you know what? You guys got to get into social networking, man. Get these kids interested somehow.
It is a challenge. There's no doubt. It's sometimes I think, you know, some of the video games and the technology that's seen in the video games is sometimes it's starting to outpace our ability to actually match that with real technology. Back in the Apollo era, you know, we were doing magic every day. The Apollo program was like this magic, amazing little piece of the 21st century plucked out of time and stuck down in the middle of the 20th century.
And every kid wanted to be an astronaut, Dan.
Yeah, you bet. Remember? You know, you didn't have to worry about science and math education. I mean, kids were inspired just by what was going on. It was just an absolutely magic time. And, you know, NASA still has that magic cachet. I mean, the NASA brand is one of the best on the entire planet. You know, it's at a half of a percent. Jeff is exactly right. It's not that much when you ask people on the street in surveys what, you know, just, you know, estimate, you know, what, you know, show them a pie chart, what fraction of the national budget is spent on NASA. Because of the space program's wonderful successes and its visibility, people have kind of an inflated sense of how much is spent on it, and people continuously way, way overestimate how much of the federal budget is spent. It's the pocket change lost under the sofa cushions in the NASA in the overall federal budget, and the returns are are so important. The inspiration, the real science and engineering that's done, the mission that is planet Earth itself, which is in NASA's charter to study our own planet and the place we live on, and make sure that it continues to be a good place to live on. So the agency does great stuff, and I guess with maybe a little bit more funding, we could do even better stuff. I certainly would not be against that.
We're with planetary scientist Daniel Derda, at least for the rest of this hour. First-time caller Taylor is in Seattle, Washington, and you're on Coast to Coast. Taylor, go ahead.
Hi, George. Daniel.
Hi.
So earlier you were speaking about those advanced civilizations that may be out there that could be thousands, maybe millions of years ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
And my question might require to use a little bit of imagination, but I was wondering what type of technologies that you might imagine that they would use to protect themselves from these types of asteroids. And essentially the reason I ask was there was a video that made the mainstream news over in Japan of what appeared to be a UFO destroying an asteroid by flying directly through it, and it was a breathtaking video. And I don't know if that was someone from another planet, you know, helping us out, or if it was something maybe built out in Nevada that, you know, secret. But I just
I think one of the best benefits of being an advanced spacefaring civilization is that you're not tied to a single planet, and therefore destined to the whims of celestial billiards sending a large asteroid your way. If you're a planet-faring civilization, your species is spread from world to world, and your species will survive even if any one particular world suffers some catastrophe like that. That in itself, I think, is the most important technological capability that a civilization that advanced would have, is that you're spread colonially across a small region, a small corner of the galaxy. I think that's the best benefit of being a spacefaring civilization. As far as the other technologies they may have, and I keep saying they may have, I mean, you know, again, as far as we know, science being that sort of evidence-based, you know, enterprise that it is, as far as we know, we're it. You know, we've not yet seen it.
But you know, we can't.
I would love for us to.
But you don't think we are. You know that, right?
I
deep
you know,
down
in
inside.
My heart of hearts, no, I don't believe that. Of course, I think we're there. There's just based on what we know about how life originated on this planet and how we talked about that earlier in the show, how common those materials are. That we now know for a fact that there's this great stage for the play of life and the number of planets that are out there. Salting and peppering the entire galaxy, I would find it incredibly difficult to believe that we're actually alone in the galaxy.
And I'm a believer that there's
that doesn't make any sense.
Some kind of design behind all of this, Dan. I just don't think this is a random fluke of, you know, life progressions. You know, there's got to be, there's too much order to this. I mean, here we are, you know, you look.
Well, yeah, and I guess that depends. I mean, I you know, the my scientist nature says that I can see the beauty in the designerless design of the way nature works, the natural processes of selection that will create temporary order out of what is a surrounding swarm of chaos around you. It's the natural laws that we know have a neat character of being able to do that in certain ways, but I'm certainly not going to stand there and argue with somebody who sees a grand design in the beauty of what's out there. I don't know enough to be able to stand there and definitively say that can't be the case.
I mean, how could something scientifically evolve? You need eyes to see, right? In order to accomplish things, you get eyes. You need ears to hear, so you can hear things going on in your environment. You get ears. You have to smell or breathe. You get a nose. You want to open your mouth to eat. I mean, it's an amazing mechanism.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's and that's what is so fun about the process of science. The verb that is science, not the noun. I mean, I always try to emphasize that to people. It's not just this collection of facts and things out there. It's a process by which we figure this all out. As far as we know, it's the best process we have. It's the same sort of forensic thing that, you know, goes on in our you know, when you're dealing with solving a criminal case, it's, you know, you go, nature's throwing these puzzles at us, and it's up to us to try to figure it out. And it's the joy and the pure pleasure of that process. Humans like to solve mysteries, and that's deep ingrained in our species. That's why I think it was an empowering force for us, right? That's why we're still here as a species, is we were good at doing that. So I think that's why it's so deep in our nature to find the pleasure in figuring these things out. Yeah. That's whether it's by science or other processes that give you the joy of understanding the world in your own way. I'm not gonna argue with how that works.
Jeff is in St. Louis on the Wild Card line. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you, George?
Good, Jeffrey. Thank you.
Hey, I got a question for your guest there. And the question is that he may or may not know somebody that he might have worked with at NASA. She is also an artist, and she's painted some very beautiful airbrush murals for NASA. And she also worked at SETI in New Mexico, and her name is Carol L. Carroll. Do you know her?
Oh, not personally, but I think I'm aware of her work. I've certainly met a lot of colleagues in my years in the science community and in the NASA community who that creative passion that I just described from the science and technical side,
right, that's why I called,
spills over into the artistic side as well. Absolutely.
Right. And did you ever see the murals that she painted at NASA or the planets with airbrush?
I believe I have, actually. Yes. Beautiful stuff. Absolutely.
I have not seen him yet. I met her here in St. Louis, Michigan, of course. And
oh, great.
She travels all the way around the country, did for a while, and she was painting and volunteer painting. She painted several Pueblo Indian schools, mm-hmm. the whole thing, inside mm-hmm. and out mural, and she's just the
That's great. Well, I love to see it. You know, like I say, it's the artist in me loves to see the work of other artists like that. It's I'm a member of the International Association of Astronomical Artists, and it's a great and wonderful family of people who I've never seen a group more willing to share their techniques and their discoveries of, you know, better ways to do this and do that art wise. It's a great family to be in, and it's a lot of fun.
Let's go to Dave now, truck driving in Phoenix. David, welcome to the show.
You're doing a wonderful job.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Well, why is it if we figure that the physics that we know of are the baseline for all of physics in the universe, then wouldn't it be the case that if we got hit by a big enough meteorite or object, it wouldn't move the Earth like a billiard ball?
Oh, well, yeah, that's you're exactly right. You know, action reaction being what it is, that is indeed going to be the case.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, I mean that there's no arguing with the physics of that reaction. The only issue is that there's really not much in the solar system these days that is big enough to have that sort of an effect on us. Even the largest asteroids in the near Earth population are pretty small. I mean, you know, even the dinosaur killing sort of stuff is just a mosquito hitting the window of your truck driving down the highway.
I wonder if you used a pea to hit a billiard ball, if it would move. I don't think it would. But if you used
if it's a fast enough pea, it would.
You think it would?
Oh, absolutely. If you fire that pea fast enough at that billiard ball, you're going to see
it's
MV momentum. And if V is big enough, you're going to get a momentum change on that billiard ball. Absolutely. That's actually one of the techniques we have for deflecting a dangerous asteroid, is to ram a small spacecraft into that asteroid. The key being, it's a small spacecraft, so you've got to go really fast. But if you go really fast, you're going to get enough ejecta and enough momentum transfer in that impact that you can affect the orbital change. So even with the Earth, if you were to slam another, you know, like a Mars-sized body into the Earth, oh, you're darn right, you'd see a reaction.
Let's go to another caller. Robert's in Sanford, Florida now. Hey, Robert, go ahead.
Hey, George, thank you so much. This is your ex-medic buddy that was a lightning strike victim.
How are
you? Hey, thanks for having me on, buddy. I appreciate it, and you're doing a fantastic job. Daniel, I have a very complex question for you, and please bear with me because it's very difficult to verbalize to you. Now imagine you have the Earth in your hand, and you have, say, a light bulb or whatever. So you got a softball in your hand. That represents the Earth. You got a light bulb, you know, bare light bulb. That's the sun. Uh-huh. Now, the way we're standing, I'm in Florida right now, so in relation to me standing straight up in Florida versus standing, somebody standing straight up over the equator, I'm about 40 degrees in relation to that person. Okay.
Yep.
So
yep.
You follow me
yep.
so far?
Yep. Absolutely. Yep. Yep.
Okay. Now, I'm wondering if you're in your professional career, if this question has ever come up or been posed to you. We can see the Big and Little Dippers 365 days out of the year. Now,
yep.
contrary, to
Northern
belief,
Hemisphere,
we,
yep.
contrary to popular belief, we do not wobble so much as our axis in relation to the orbit around the sun is tilted. Correct?
That's correct. Yeah, about 23 and a half degrees, the whole reason for the seasons, if you will.
Exactly. Now, let's go to 6 months from now. We technically shouldn't be able to see the Big and Little Dippers because what we're seeing now at night, 6 months from now, will be in the daytime. Correct?
Relative to the sun. Ah, okay, here we go. Yeah, so that axial tilt now, picture the North Pole, that axial tilt on one side of the sun pointing out toward the North Star, if you will.
Yes.
You're pointing away from the sun on this part of the orbit. 6 months later, you're tilted back more toward the sun, so you're thinking now you're more into like the summertime in the Northern Hemisphere, but that North Pole
yeah,
is still pointing off way far away off into space toward the North Star. So,
correct.
Speaking from the grand distance of the stars, that North Pole is pretty much well fixed in space. Over a period of like about 25,000 years, that pole will wobble and precess around like a wobbling top. That's a very much longer period. So the North Star we see today is not, you know, Polaris is not going to be our North Star several thousand years from now. But over the course of you know, a human lifetime, if you will, over the course of years of the Earth orbiting the sun, that axis is pretty well fixed in space.
Daniel, can you believe 13 years ago when I did my very first Coast to Coast show, 13 years ago, you were the first guest?
It's been a lot of fun over the years, too, I tell you.
My gosh.
Always enjoy talking with you, and we always get such great questions.
And we've dodged the asteroids so far.
Well, we won't do it forever, so we'll continue to come on and we'll continue to discuss it.
All right, Dan, thanks a lot. Dan Derrida, planetary scientist. Up next, Jeffrey Mishlove joins us. We are going to be talking about free will. We're going to be talking about the mind's ability next.